Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. My colleague and co-host, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com contributor, is here with me. And earlier, we had occasion to watch the developing conflict zone, the South China Sea, where the PLA Navy is building artificial islands. And the United States Navy has made it very clear over the last week that the freedom of navigation, the freedom of the seas, is paramount to maintaining law and order around the globe, transparency, the growth of the economies in Asia with our Asian allies and the United States, and also the rest of the world, freedom of navigation. That is a conflict we can see out in the open. What is much more difficult is to see the conflict of the Chinese economy, where the tension is, what is worrying the leadership in China, and what they're doing about it. Gordon, a very good evening to you. The Chinese economy continues to bump along a little below 50% when we talk about manufacturing level. And we see that there is a GDP disappointment dripping down these last years. And what the Chinese have been doing, they've been adjusting interest rates, they've been creating opportunities for export and import, but they've also been adding stimulus money. How do they do that?
Well, John, they've been spending on a tear. For the first 4 months of this year, fiscal spending is up about 33%. And that's the reason because monetary stimulus, which they've been trying since about last November or so, has essentially not worked. They've created a lot of money, but they haven't created very much growth. And that's a problem for them. And so the only reliable way for them to create GDP is to actually go out and build something.
We welcome Ann Stevenson Yang, co-founder of J Capital Research. Ann is the author of China Alone, The Emergence From and Potential Return to Isolation, and has toured China and looked at the product of the GDP growth these last years, sometimes called ghost cities. There's other wasted production. And right now, the stimulus program that Gordon points to, what is the best case scenario for the Chinese leadership? How does it work?
John, it really is kind of reverting to the old strategies that worked 6 years ago for them because they're kind of out of ideas. But new investment programs and stimulus programs are really the last thing that China needs now. But they're kind of in a panic about the decline of growth. And so we're getting announcements really every day about new stimulus programs. So far, it's up to 42 trillion renminbi within China, and about half a trillion U.S. dollars overseas in stimulus money.
And this is really important because if we go back to 2008, when you mentioned that six-year period, Premier Wen Jiabao, who was the economic czar at the time, launched what was probably the biggest stimulus program in history. And he created growth, but he also created a lot of debt and an asset bubble, which we now see in the property market. And everybody in China has said this was not a good idea. This was overdoing it. But what we see right now is that Premier Li Ka-chung, Wen Jiabao's successor, is now going out and doing the same thing, and he might be going out and doing it in the same size, another world-beating stimulus program. You talked about panic. This really strikes me as being desperate on the part of Chinese leaders to go out and do something that everybody knows was a bad idea the first time.
I think it is a sign of desperation, but it also is an indication of how few strategies the Chinese government really has. And they really just don't have a lot of other things to do. And so there are all these, you know, extravagant announcements, but the big difference is that now it's not really working. It's like pushing on a string, whereas back in 2009, they were sort of pushing on a stick. And the difference now is that the world is not interested in having renminbi. There's just too much supply in China and not enough demand overseas. So no matter how much stimulus you provide, nobody really wants the stuff. You're just creating more capacity that nobody needs.
The image that I have burned in my memory is watching Ann Stevenson Yang and Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes tromping around Tianjin's new financial center, which was a lot of tall buildings, some of them not completed, and certainly no people, no cars, no business, just these two women walking along this dusty street. And this was GDP growth. And the question is, well, if that was then, a year or 2 years ago, what is it going to be going forward? I don't see it. I do see a real problem right now, a failure of imagination.
Yeah, that's why if you were in charge of China, the best thing that anybody, any leader could do for China would be to say, stop. Just stop building this stuff. But nobody can take the political pain. You know, we understand how that works in politics, and it's unfortunate, but that's just the case.
Unemployment. Can we see it? Can we guess at it? The results, the logical results of what you're saying is that it's growing. Where?
Well, I think that you see some, you see unemployment growing in some core industrial sectors, particularly coal mining and steel, but you don't really see it in the coastal cities yet or light industrial areas, and I'm not exactly sure why.
Well, part of it is because the workforce is declining, so that helps a little bit. And I think also a part of it is, you know, in the work that J Capital Research, your firm does, there's been a lot of stories that we've seen in your research notes about how the government sort of manage things, like having state enterprises buy empty apartments. So therefore, you create the demand to build more empty apartments so more state enterprises can buy more flats. I guess perhaps that's the reason why we haven't seen the unemployment problem really mature.
Yeah, I mean, it seems unfortunately inevitable, but exactly when is very hard to say.
Because we're looking, because it's non-transparent, does anyone have a timeline for what we're witnessing? All the logic says that this is a severe recession. They're contracting. But when can they no longer hide it with these, well, by printing money, which is what they're doing. They're printing credit. They're creating credit out of nothing in order to roll loans over. How much longer, Anne?
I think the currency is what forces honesty in the end, because right now, all these wealthy Chinese who can get $1 for every 6.1 renminbi realize that that's a deal that they're not going to be getting in the future, and everybody's running for the door. So the amount of money leaving the country right now is quite shockingly high, and that's a big reversal. Until a year ago, China was a net recipient of money. Now it's a net loser. And so that's what's going to affect the government and cause them to depreciate the currency, and then everyone will lose confidence.
One more detail. Gordon mentions to me that there looks to be a scheme to loan money to overseas partners, say the BRICS, say other countries in Latin America, and then to have them buy Chinese goods. In other words, create demand. In the same way Gordon just explained, you have companies buy empty apartments and then create demand. Is that enough? Are there enough loans overseas that you can make Brazilians buy Chinese steel?
Well, there is the problem of running out of resources, and there just isn't enough money in the world to fund these things. But I think the critical issue is that no matter how many, you know, how many roads and railroads you build in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, in the end, those are very small markets, and they don't replace the decline in housing construction in China.
Gordon, more ghost cities, that's what we're going to see, more what you call a lot rot, more of cars that nobody drives.
Yeah, I think that's essentially what they're going, because they're building all this stuff right now. There wasn't demand before they started building, so how can they create demand? Their problem is there's a fundamental lack of demand in China, and there's very little way that they can get around that.
And I remember reading the stories, you know, Pearl Buck, back 80 years ago. This is sentimental China. You couldn't fool the Chinese farmer. You just couldn't do it. That was always the payoff when you talked about the schemes of Beijing. Is the Chinese farmer now the Chinese consumer, the Chinese business person, the Chinese manufacturer, same people, and they can't be fooled? Do I understand that nothing's changed?
I think you can fool a lot of the people a lot of the time, but also people, when it comes to economic issues, are uncannily aware of their own advantage. So they might not be able to articulate, oh, the currency is overvalued or whatever that might be, but they act in their own interest. And that means that Chinese people right now are looking for every which way to move their money overseas, to buy stuff outside of the country, to have stocks outside of the country and so forth. And that's because they realized that that the clock is ticking.
Ann Stevenson Yang, co-founder of J Capital Research in Beijing. She's the author of China Alone, The Emergence From and Potential Return to Isolation. Gordon Chang, a Forbes.com contributor. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang, Forbes.com contributor, is here. Useful idiots, a political term. You've heard it. Sometimes called useful fools. That's the Russian translation. In history, the BBC radio documentary reported useful idiots included the unfortunate Walter Duranty, a New York Times correspondent, rewarded, who reported on falsehoods about Stalin's tyranny in the 1930s, and was applauded again and again by friends of Russia on the ballroom floor of the Waldorf Astoria in a very famous celebration, the send-off of the Russian foreign minister. Useful idiot. I just want you to remember that term when we turn to the next story. Gordon, recently there were a number of women transported to the DMZ by the North Koreans. To what purpose?
They were going to walk across the DMZ, but at last-minute plans, they were bussed across, and they were there to promote reconciliation, peace, and all the other good things that, of course, come with cooperation with the Kim regime. And they were led by Gloria Steinem, two Nobel Peace laureates, and 27 other useful idiots.
Gregory Scarlato, Greg Scarlato, Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Greg, a very good morning to you in Seoul. The media in Seoul, how did they report this demonstration? And especially, who is Christine Ahn? Good morning.
Good evening, John and Gordon. I have to say that I did not meet any South Koreans who are too enthusiastic about this so-called march through the DMZ. In particular, North Korean escapees were quite appalled. North Korean women who escaped North Korea went through this harrowing escape and finally found their way into South Korea were very upset by what they saw as nothing but a Kim regime love fest being brought down south to South Korea. The reports by the South Korean press were rather critical, cold at best. Remember that this group basically engaged in flower offerings, honoring the memory of the same man who basically started the Korean War by attacking South Korea, Kim Il-sung. They made statements. You're asking me about Christine Ahn. KCNA, the North Korean propaganda organization, relayed a statement by Christine Ahn praising the memory of Kim Il-sung and praising the North Korean regime. This group refused to address the very hard human rights issues. This is a regime that's committing crimes against humanity in North Korea against its own people. This group blames the tense situation on the Korean Peninsula on the so-called American militarism, and they did this right on Memorial Day weekend.
Greg, I'm actually speechless. Why would they do this? Why would Gloria Steinem, who is a well-respected activist, why would she participate in a debacle like this?
She is getting very wrong advice from the wrong people. Previously, she made statements that she basically trusts Christine Ahn and others whom she calls area experts. They're by no means experts. This is an extraordinarily flawed worldview, to say the least. And quite frankly, although I was critical of this initiative, you may recall I co-authored an op-ed in the Washington Post with Rabbi Abraham Cooper of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, suggesting that this group should rather visit the border regions with China to protest the forcible repatriation of North Korean refugees by China to conditions of danger. We suggested that if North Korea is truly interested in a peace gesture, they should allow those hundreds of POWs, South Korean POWs in their 80s and 90s, to return home. They've been holding them for so many decades. But somehow I still hope that something good might come out of this, but it turns out that this is once again nothing but an exercise meant to pretty much praise the Kim regime, a love fest worshiping the Kim regime. It's an exercise that comes disturbingly close to the position and negotiating objectives of the Kim regime. The group claims that it's not about political issues, so to say. It's all about citizen-to-citizen contacts. And nevertheless, just a couple of days ago, they stated that they would become a permanent presence, a group tasked to, quote-unquote, lobby the U.S. government for a peace treaty and the lifting of sanctions against North Korea. Now, we know the path to lifting of sanctions against North Korea, that is complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement of North Korea's nuclear weapons program. They've been threatening neighbors, including South Korea, with their nuclear program and their missile program. And, of course, the path to a peace treaty and normalization is also a solution to this appalling human rights situation. This group is praising and worshiping this regime while the Kim regime is running a vast system of unlawful imprisonment. 120,000 people in political prison camps, in gulags, oftentimes members of three generations of the same family, pursuant to a system of guilt by association.
Let me read the quote from Christine Ahn. This is to CNN in April, a couple of months ago, before this event. Basically, she says, that is a Cold War McCarthyist mentality when she's accused of sympathizing for North Korea. She goes on to say, and that kind of framework has enabled Korea to remain divided. I am pro-peace. I am pro-engagement. I am pro-dialogue. I am pro-human rights. Gordon, this is surprising. This is textbook useful idiot. Textbook.
Well, it certainly is. And you know, the South Korean government, led by President Park Geun-hye, has tried to engage the North, and they've been pro-engagement, pro-dialogue, pro-human rights. And unfortunately, Seoul hasn't gotten very far in dealing with the Kim regime. And I think the reason is that Kim Jong-un is just not in a position to deal in good faith with anybody outside of North Korea.
Right. Suppose I was Kim Jong-un, and suppose I was an idiot, but I repeat myself. Greg Scarlato, the Executive Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. I'm John Batchelor with Gordon Chang. I'm John Batchelor, Gordon Chang, Forbes.com contributor is here with me, and we're off to China. This is our colleague Abhik Bhattacharya, who writes, heard on the street for the Wall Street Journal, he's in Hong Kong, and this is the story of a bubble. It sounds like a fairy tale. Once upon a time, a company, Hanergy Thin Film Power, was a fresh investment idea because it's a solar energy company, and the stock climbed in a few months. But then again, you remember the Chinese stock market has been climbing since last fall, right, Gordon? It's up about 100%. Yeah, so everything's been climbing. All boats are lifted by the tide. This particular company, though, has a wonderful middle. We haven't come to the end yet. It climbs from $2 all the way till about $8, $8 Hong Kong. And it's floating along around $7, and everybody's well-to-do, and it is made of one man, the owner, extremely wealthy. I mean, billions and billions wealthy. And then, well, that's why Abhik's here, to tell us what happens to a fairy tale when it crashes. Abhik, a very good morning to you. Hanergy Thin Film Power. I see on my chart here accompanying your story, went from about $7 to about $4 in, what is that, seconds? What happened that morning? What do we know? Good morning to you.
Well, thanks for having me, John. This is a story that has gripped Hong Kong because this was a stock that rose 7 times in value in the last 1 year and then came crashing down and lost 47% of its value. And I think, as you alluded, less than an hour of trading. And so some of us journalists are still trying to investigate and still trying to figure out all the pieces to this puzzle. But what we do know, and the Wall Street Journal reported this on Saturday in the U.S., that you know, this is sort of like a flash crash where this is a stock that had kept going at incredibly high in value because people kept bidding it higher and higher and higher. And then suddenly last Wednesday at about 10:16 a.m. Hong Kong time, someone just forgot to put in the bids, or someone could not put in the bids. We obviously don't know why exactly there were no bids. And so the sell orders began overwhelming the buy orders, and the price just plummeted. So that's sort of the story now. But of course, this is a stock that, either partly because of mania around this concept of a newfangled solar company, and also possibly because of manipulation, which is what many people suspect kept the stock up so high, we're still trying to disentangle how much of this was mania and how much manipulation.
So Abhik, the chairman of the company,
Lee Hee-jun.
Did he have a short interest in his stock?
So there's been a lot of reports about a so-called short position that he seems to have in his stock, which is about 7 or 8% of all the shares outstanding. And I think, according to Hong Kong law, what is a short position is different from what you or I or your listeners would think of as a short position. Traditionally, a short position means that you are betting against the stock. So you borrow the stock, and then you sell it in anticipation that the price will fall, and then you would buy it back. But in this case, this is think of it as a derivative position where I have gotten a loan from someone, and in exchange, I have promised to deliver the shares to you. So the shares are sort of like collateral to you, my lender, in exchange for which I've just gotten your loan. So this isn't, you know, literally a short position, but it does suggest, though we don't know entirely for certain and to what degree, that he used the stock as collateral to get a lot of loans.
So there are reports that he lost, 14 or so billion in a space of an hour or so. So he very well may not have lost that if he indeed were on what was in Hong Kong considered to be the short side of stuff.
No, because I don't think he's actually profiting from the fall in the stock, or at least we don't know this for certain. If the short position is actually as a collateral for loans he's gotten, then the value of that collateral has also dropped in value when the stock plummeted by nearly half, right? So if the value of that collateral has gone down in value, then if I'm the guy who's lent him all this money, then I will suddenly demand that something be different, that he produce some cash or something or the other, because what I'm left holding as collateral has now almost evaporated.
It's now a week later since you filed a report. Is the stock still trading? Is it still...
Actually, this is another interesting mystery, that the stock is still not trading. It's still suspended from trading.
And we don't know why. 7 days later? We don't know 7 days later. Very odd. Now, look, this is a market. I understand people make decisions on the basis of profit and loss. But is there any hand in here that we need to talk about? Say, Beijing hand.
No, actually, this would be one case where I think there is no Beijing hand, at least so far as we know. This being China, it's entirely possible that everything I just said turns out to be wrong. But I don't see Lee Hee-jun as a politically connected figure. I think he certainly profited from a lot of the government mania and interest in renewable sources of energy like solar. But otherwise, I don't really see a political connection.
All right, Gordon, what we'd have to say is this is illustrative of the mysteries of the Shanghai market right now. We could say that if there is a road forward, we'll get the rest of the story. We're just in the middle of this.
Right, and clearly you have a market which just does not operate according to the way we think markets should operate, because you shouldn't have a stock just fall in half in an hour.
Or rise 29 times in the last 6 months. All right, let's say that it's beyond our understanding at this moment, but we could be enlightened later. Let's move to the India market, because Abhik has also filed on the India market, which has been a great excitement since the election of Mr. Modi, the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and the sweeping out of the Congress Party and the sweeping in of the BJP, and Mr. Modi's traveled the world. He continues to travel, making friends. He's a jovial figure, easy to like. However, what I understand is that the stock market rose in anticipation and has been frustrated and has now fallen. And you like that, Abhik. How so?
Well, I like it because, let's go back a little here. The Indian stock market rose in incredible anticipation even before Modi came to power. And that was obviously a case of what I think of as sort of a mini-mania, because Modi was an untested figure at the national level, and we, to a large extent, did not know the policies he would put in place. But even after he came into power and some of the policies he put in place were not the big transformational changes that many people expected, stocks kept rising. So it happened. It took a series of bad moves, or perhaps the fact that the slow pace of reforms really got to investors, that around early May, stocks started really correcting. And the way to measure expectations in this case is by what we look at as the price earnings ratio. So which is the price at which the Indian stocks are trading, divided by what people think their earnings are going to be this year. And one measure of how inflated these expectations were is that Indian stocks were trading at a price earnings ratio of 19 times earnings around February. Now, to put that in historical context, Indian stocks usually historically don't trade above, say, 15 or 16 times. So for them to trade at 19 times is really frothy. So when Indian stocks actually correct, as they did in May, and they corrected below their historical average, my sense is this is a buying opportunity if things are below the sort of mean level that they've been trading at for the last 10 years or so.
Abhik, that would certainly be true if the Indian economy is going to grow at an accelerated pace. Is that in fact going to be the case?
That is a very good question, and my sense here is that, you know, the earlier extremely high price earnings ratio or high expectations, you know, what they priced in, as we say, or what people expected from that, was that India would grow at incredible rates and there'd be a lot of reform. Now, we think that is not going to happen, and that's partly because the pace of reform isn't going to be so great. Modi seems like an incrementalist, much more than a transformational leader, and also because, frankly, in a nation of 1.2 billion people, changing the growth rate to a new plane of growth in just a matter of 1 year is near impossible. But what is happening now is that India is making a few, there are a few good regulatory changes that are going on, and growth, a lot because of natural reasons and partly because of some of these regulatory changes, is improving slowly. And if as long as the stock market acknowledges that growth is improving, albeit slowly, then this is a good opportunity if the expectations are in line with reality.
How is the rupee, after all the disappointment? Has it recovered?
The rupee has been relatively stable compared to, your listeners might remember how the rupee was one of the worst performing currencies in the world in the year 2013, when there was this taper tantrum and people pulled out of emerging markets and India was one of the worst hit. The good news is in the last 2 years, India's currency has been far more stable, and a lot of credit should go to the central bank governor, Raghuram Rajan, who was a famous IMF official and also professor at the University of Chicago, who at the helm of the Indian Central Bank has more or less kept a strict line on targeting inflation, and which has really helped investors understand and get more confident in the currency.
The reason I ask about the rupee is that one of the advantages with a strong currency is that it invites investors from outside. Are you seeing that in India right now?
That is certainly an idea, and that could be something that drives some investors at the margin. But the main thing that has excited investors in the India story, at least with stocks, was the Modi growth potential. Rajan certainly provided a stabilizing effect, but as far as the stock market is concerned, what enamored them is this idea of transformational change.
Let's go back to Hong Kong and compare that. Gordon, the renminbi, the yuan, do we believe it's valued correctly? Anne was suggesting earlier that it's not.
Well, the IMF just a couple days ago said that it was not undervalued, and that's probably right because we have seen the Chinese central bank defend the renminbi because, as Anne talked about, a lot of money is leaving China, and that is depressing the currency. And if the central bank weren't defending it, it probably would collapse.
And Abhik, we've just talked about the India market and the rupee being strong and inviting investors. That isn't necessary to explain the Shanghai market. That's just gambler's delight. Is that the way to regard it?
Yes, that would be the right way to look at it. The India market is actually, you know, in many ways so different from the Shanghai market. The Shanghai market is dominated by retail investors, and a lot of things depend on hearsay or depend on just frank rumor. In India, the market is actually surprisingly dominated by foreign investors, though in recent weeks, Indian local investors are making a comeback. But the foreign investors trade on, one would think, a slightly more reasonable and fundamental idea of what is going on in the economy and what is going on with stocks and earnings and companies. Of course, that said, both countries are still developing countries, which means everything that the government does is paramount.
Abhik Bhattacharya, Heard on the Street, Wall Street Journal, Gordon Chang, a Forbes.com contributor. I'm John Batchelor. John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Peter Berkowitz, writing most recently at Real Clear Politics. Peter is at the Hoover Institution. In observation of a new book, The Obama Doctrine, American Grand Strategy Today, Colin Duick is the author. Peter has read it. I have not. However, in Peter's essay, I discern a question that we all have all the time now, watching these ticking clocks about the suspect secret nuclear weapons program in Iran and whether there will be a deal. At the same time, question of the Middle East and the collapse of Iraq into a civil war, the collapse of Syria into a civil war, Yemen, I could go on, and the rise of the Islamic State. American grand strategy. Does Obama have one for the Middle East? Are we witnessing it? And what is to be done going forward? Because Mr. Obama will move on into history, and there will be a new presidency in January 2017. To inherit what? Peter, a very good evening to you. First, Colin Duick's theory, thesis, the Obama Doctrine, the American Grand Strategy Today. Something tells me in your essay that it is not a positive verdict. Good evening to you, Peter.
Good evening, John. You're correct. It's not a positive verdict. Duick asks us to look about, as you've done, in the Middle East, but also the failure of the Russian reset, the greater assertiveness of China in the South China Sea and elsewhere since Obama has become president. And he says, you know, it's tempting to conclude that the president hasn't got a plan. Duick says, resist the temptation. He's got a plan. Duick calls it a grand strategy. You might call it an anti-grand strategy, but it is a way of thinking about foreign policy. And according to Duick, and I think Duick makes a lot of sense of what we see about us, Obama's, we'll call it a strategy, amounts to this: retrench and accommodate abroad, the better to pursue a progressive domestic policy agenda at home.
We've been watching this for 6 years. We've been watching the domestic policy. I guess Obamacare qualifies, certainly, yeah. Dodd-Frank, and some, perhaps the stimulus, all passed in the first 2 years. And since then, the domestic policy, the progressive domestic policy, has been an argument between the president and the House of Representatives, now between the president and Congress. But I want to go overseas. The retrenchment, is that what we're witnessing in Iraq? Is that retrenchment, according to Mr. Duick?
Well, that's interesting. Of course, it's partly retrenchment, yes, in this, Of course, what does retrenchment mean? It means cutting costs and lowering America's profile abroad. So, yes, that does constitute a kind of retrenchment. Ill-advised, in my judgment, yes. And it also involves that accommodation of which Duke spoke. In other words, what does accommodation mean in Obama's hands? Well, it means first assuming that conflict in the international arena arises from misunderstanding, and then assuming that because the United States understands things so much better, we, the United States, will make concessions, and those who appear to our adversaries will behave better.
Grand strategy, then. The Obama doctrine so far, one measure would be it's still underway. We're watching the negotiation with Iran. There is, at this point, aspiration for remedies in Syria, for remedies in Iraq. However, when we come to 2017, let's stand in January 2017, there will be a new president. The grand strategy looks incomplete at best. At best, it looks incomplete. Does Mr. Duick believe that that was Mr. Obama's intention, to disturb, to upset, to at some point disorder the whole Middle East? Was that a success?
No, I don't think it's. I don't think he believes that it was Obama's intention to bring about disorder. I think that Duick believes that disorder, however, is an inevitable consequence of essentially a strategy of avoidance or neglect, a strategy that was designed to lower America's responsibilities for maintaining international order. So, and now, of course, in the short term, Obama seems to have secured his progressive agenda. But has he really? He's helped provoke a Republican backlash. Republicans are stronger in the House and Senate than they have been in generations, and very strong on the state level. Moreover, whoever enters the White House in 2017 is going to face a bevy of very serious foreign policy challenges. I hardly think that President Obama has remade the world in his image. What he has done is left tremendous challenges for the United States and his successor.
Does Mr. Duick believe that the president's achievements are chiefly rhetorical then, jaw, because there are no facts on the ground to substantiate his hopes?
Well, he certainly believes that Obama has no achievements whatever to speak of in the international arena. Obama has not achieved anything really to speak of in counterterrorism. Guantanamo Bay is still open. Obama's had to step up the use of drones and so on. We're less popular now than we were under Bush in Islamic countries. As you pointed out, the Middle East is on fire. Russia and China are more assertive. So there are no accomplishments to speak of. And even if we sign a deal with Iran, by all accounts, it's going to be, I shouldn't say by all accounts, but by almost all accounts, it's going to be a bad deal, which is going to provoke Saudi Arabia and other Middle East countries to go nuclear. So what Duick says is this. True, Obama doesn't have any foreign policy achievements, but he wasn't aiming for those. He was aiming for the domestic policy achievements. But you make the point, John. How much of that is really going to be left, given that Obama's overreach has seemed to empower Republicans?
The final puzzle, then, with Mr. Obama's foreign policy, because it'll be looked upon for the rest of this century. At this point, is Mr. Obama worried about Mr. Carter? You know, the damage that was done during the Carter years, we found long afterwards. It wasn't obvious in 1979, 1980 that Iran would become a predator state. Is that going to be the same for Mr. Obama, that he's created monsters we can't see yet?
I myself believe that scenario is more likely than not. Whether the president thinks about it in those terms, I really can't say. But again, his successor will inherit enormous challenges.
Right.
You put it this way, by focusing on short-term gain on the domestic front, Obama has opened the door to tremendous costs long-term abroad.
Peter Berkowitz, writing most recently at Real Clear Politics, on the book is Mr. Obama, The Grand Strategy. Colin Duick is the author. The Obama Doctrine, American Grand Strategy Today. Peter Berkowitz is at the Hoover Institution. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show.